From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the chairman of the House Committee on Detroit's Bankruptcy Aid explains why helping the struggling city is good for the state.
Bringing resolution saves the state money. It helps our pensioners keep their dignity. It helps remove this cloud over our state and give us a chance to move forward.
How's the sign-up going for Michigan's expanded Medicaid system, and what's stopping those who are newly eligible from signing up?
One of the leading studies done so far shows that the primary reason people don't attempt to get themselves enrolled is they think there is not going to be an affordable plan available to them. Now, that's not the case.
Plus, why I stay? What keeps us living in Michigan?
We're not an in-and-out state. You come here and you're born here and you tend to stay here. It's what's not to like, I think.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Healthy Michigan, the state's expanded Medicaid health care system for low-income Michiganders, is up and running after much controversy surrounding its passage in the state legislature. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, are the politics of Obamacare stopping people from enrolling? Then, only 28% of us say Michigan is the best or one of the best possible states to live in. So, why do you stay in Michigan?
Sleeping Bear Dunes, Saugatuck. But also, as you expect, we see a lot of things about family and community and, you know, the people that they're connected to in the state as well.
Who else can tattoo the shape of their state on their arm and have it mean anything? You know, Ohio is just not much of a tattoo.
We'll get details on Michigan Radio's Why I Stay project later this hour. But first, Michigan took a step closer to putting money down on the table for Detroit's grand bargain. The newly formed House Committee on Detroit's Recovery and Michigan's Future approved yesterday an 11-bill package that would see the state send $194.8 million to Detroit, and it would create a panel to oversee city finances for at least 13 years. At this moment, the bills are being voted on in the entire House. We're joined now by the chair of that House committee, Republican from Livonia, State Representative John Walsh. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
As you chaired the committee, Representative, and went through the hearings, what were your biggest concerns about this package?
Well, we wanted to have a very careful balance of an investment by the state to bring the funds necessary to be part of the global settlement of the bankruptcy, and at the exact same time assure our citizens that the money would be used appropriately, that it would be invested in the city's future, and have some ability to have oversight so that we can have some degree of assurance it won't fall back into bankruptcy. It was a very delicate balance because we want the city to run itself. We want the mayor and the council to have their authority, but our taxpayers do have the right to have an opportunity for some period to oversee the use of the funds.
Tell me what you believe makes this package of $194.8 million. Why is this a good deal for Michigan taxpayers?
The money is big, to be sure, but if we don't settle, I'll just give you a few figures that move me considerably. The cuts to the pensioners would have to be so severe in the absence of state money that it's, on a conservative estimate, there would be about $270 million in additional cost to the state over 20 years. Because of the social safety net. There's so many pensioners would fall into that social safety net, we'd have a cost of $270 million. So I think right there alone, it's a good deal. Number two, we're going to save over $20 million a year on litigation fees. We'll avoid the uncertainty of having a bankruptcy linger over the top of us for that period of time. And that lingering over us has a cost. The city can't borrow on the markets at a competitive rate. The state has an impact as a result of the bankruptcy, and even other local municipalities. So bringing resolution saves the state money. It helps our pensioners keep their dignity. It helps remove this cloud over our state and give us a chance to move forward.
And now as it moves forward to the full House, what do you hear from your caucus? Aren't there just going to be lawmakers, possibly even a majority of lawmakers, who say they don't want to bail out Detroit? I mean, we hear that time and time again.
There are people who feel that way, and they reflect the frustration that a lot of our citizens hold, and it's not a Republican or a Democratic position. I maintain it's a concerned citizen's position. The easy answer is no. We just don't want to fund. We just don't want to bail out. But when you look at the totality of what's at risk, not just for Detroit, but the entire state of Michigan, the proper answer is the balanced package that we've put forward to allow us all to move forward.
Now, we've heard that the Koch brothers, through the group Americans for Prosperity, are promising to do whatever they can to torpedo this so-called grand bargain. Can you envision them being able to do that by putting pressure on Republican state lawmakers, perhaps those who haven't made up their minds yet?
They certainly can try. It's their First Amendment right to advocate as they see fit. I don't believe that they'll be successful in torpedoing this. We have made a powerful, balanced, legal, financial, economic, and conservative argument for doing this. I don't know to what depth AFP has looked into all of the details on this package, but they might have some impact, but I don't think it torpedoes the deal.
Now, what do you hear in conversations with members of the state Senate? What kind of reception do you think this package will get once it hits the Senate?
Right now, they're not engaged because they are primarily focused on roads, and they just passed out a minimum wage bill or package last week. So even though we all work in the same capital and we're together often, each chamber tends to focus on the bills that are right in front of them. I sense receptivity. There's going to be some work to educate their members, both Republican and Democrat, as to what the bill package is. But I'm not sensing outright hostility or I'm not concerned. It's going to take work. But I think there will be receptivity to the package.
Representative Walsh, the name of the committee that you chaired, the Committee on Detroit's Recovery and Michigan's Future, did you help craft that name, I'm wondering?
I sat down with Speaker Bolger when we were talking about the what the committee might look like. And I have to say it was his suggestion, and I had the proud opportunity to agree.
And what does that name say to you?
What it says is Detroit is part of the state, and it is. It's 7% of our population. If you take a look at Detroit and then the Tri-County area, we have 38% of our population in just those three counties, and yet it produces 44% of our tax base, the revenue. So we're intertwined, and the sooner that we can get Detroit healthy, the better our entire state can do.
Republican State Representative John Walsh, who chaired the House Committee on Detroit's Recovery and Michigan's Future. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Now, separate from the grand bargain, yesterday brought a $100 million boost to Detroit from J.P. Morgan and Chase. Yes, the bank. Having a titan of Wall Street like Jamie Dimon come to the Motor City with that big bag of money has meaning on many levels. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes joins us right now. We've heard the comments, Daniel, that J.P. Morgan could use some good PR of its own. So this is all a bid to buy a shinier image, maybe get a tax break. And your answer is whatever?
Well, listen, I've been around this town long enough, and so have you, to know that any time somebody in big business does something that is in any way philanthropic or supportive of the city of Detroit, there's always all sorts of questions raised about motivation. That's the source of my whatever. I think what's really important here is not that it's not the amount, but it's who's doing it and what it symbolizes.
The optics of this.
Yeah, and I think Detroit increasingly over the last 5 or 6 years is changing kind of the narrative of its story, starting with the auto bailouts and then the restructurings and what Ford did on its own, and now we've moved into what's happening in the city of Detroit. And I think people are seeing opportunity from the outsiders are seeing opportunity, which people on the inside have already seen, as I point out in that piece today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're probably easily more than $2 billion into private investment in the city of Detroit, starting with Dan Gilbert's Quicken Loans family of companies and then a whole host of others who have been following his suit.
And as you write, you see this as basically a $100 million vote of confidence of things that are going right in Lansing and in Detroit. As you said, how long has it been since we've been able to say that?
Well, I think that's right. And Jamie Dimon, the chairman of J.P. Morgan, made that point in various interviews yesterday. And I think it's borne out. I think he's seeing what certainly I've seen and we've talked about on your show many times, which is that you have Republicans and Democrats, you know, the mayor of Detroit and the governor of Michigan, as well as business leaders who all have different kind of views of things, suburban politicians to some extent, foundations. Everybody seems to be more pulling in pretty much the same direction than I've seen since I've been around this story dating back to the mid-90s.
So now what? He comes with this investment to be used in many, many ways, jobs and investment. But now what?
Well, now what? I think you just got to continue to, you got to execute for one thing. I mean, it's one thing. I think my big concern now is, are we going to be getting a bankruptcy plan confirmed? Yeah, probably. Are you going to have some of these investments? Yes, I think you probably will. Are you going to get a grand bargain through the legislature? Probably, although it remains to be seen. That's going to come in two pieces, first the House and then the Senate.
Right.
But the question is, really, can you make it stick? I mean, it's the same question we're talking about in the context of the autos. You know, getting some new people running Ford and General Motors. And the question is, can they maintain it? Can they maintain the discipline? And I think the answer is, we hope so, but we really don't know yet.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks for checking in with us, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Bad roads, the Rust Belt, largest city in bankruptcy. These are just a few of the more negative visions of Michigan. And a recent Gallup poll showed only 28% of Michiganders said Michigan was the best or one of the best possible states to live in. But you're still here. Why is that? That's the question Michigan Radio is asking as part of our Why I Stay project. Michigan Radio's Mark Brush is running this project. Hi, Mark. Welcome.
Thanks, Eddie.
So there has been quite a huge response to this question. What are you hearing from people?
Yeah, so this is a social media campaign that we started at the station. And basically what we're asking people to do is to tweet out or use Instagram to send a picture out to the community.
Yeah.
And then use the hashtag Why I Stay. And that photo is supposed to represent something about why they stay in Michigan. And certainly when we first introduced this idea, we heard a lot of some of the negative things like, you know, I stay because I'm stuck,
or, mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
I stay because, you know, I don't have the money to move. I stay because that's where my stuff is. You know?
Ah.
But the vast majority of stuff we're seeing are the positive things about why people are staying in Michigan.
Such as?
Well, so we're seeing a ton of things that are just basically the beautiful side of Michigan, you know, Sleeping Bear Dunes, Saugatuck, those places of solitude in the state. But also, as you expect, we see a lot of things about family and community and, you know, the people that they're connected to in the state as well.
Give me an idea of the kind of images. Just I have certainly no problem understanding the kind of image that would represent the Sleeping Bear sand dunes and maybe the solitude of
the
being
sunsets,
in a sunset.
Right.
We get those. Pure Michigan has that covered really well, too.
Right, exactly.
We all get that.
Yeah.
What are some of the more unexpected images you've seen?
Well, here's – I'm just going to – I pulled some in here. This is one that I thought was interesting because kind of what I'm seeing a lot of is – this a lot of images coming down of people together, but also beautiful places. So it seems like people want to be together, but they also want to find that place of solitude and that place of beauty in the state, mm-hmm. which this state has a lot of. So this was a picture that came across that is like a combination of both of those. So this is a picture of three people, and they're holding a Chinese lantern along the shores of Lake Michigan, and they're lighting it, and they're going to let it go.
Yes.
And their caption was, we tell people that, you know, it's important to share the picture, but a pretty picture isn't all of it. We want you to tell us what's important.
Yes.
So this person writes, I stay for days at Lake Michigan with my favorite people and one perfect stranger carrying a Chinese lantern. So this is a couple that was on the beach,
and
a stranger
came
up with a Chinese lantern. They helped him launch it.
And that says an awful lot. This project, Why I Stay, is happening at other public radio stations around. How does the response here in Michigan compare to, say, let's say, New York?
Yeah, so this is in response to that Gallup poll that you mentioned at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And Gallup did this poll throughout all 50 states. So we in the public radio system decided, let's start this project together. So there were 10 stations that did it. There was Seattle, Boston, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, several other states that did it, West Virginia. And that we're all using the same hashtag, Why I Stay. But we see the vast majority of images coming through are coming from Michigan and West Virginia.
Huh.
And we don't know exactly why that is. There's a lot of discussion, you know,
yes.
online about why that's happening. We have our theories. I mean, here in Michigan, we certainly talk a lot about how do we come back. We were the only state that lost population in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably top of mind for a lot of people. And these images are just flooding out.
Interesting. Yeah. So Mark Brush, why do you stay?
I stay for my family, my kids, and also the beauty. And this Friday, I'm headed north with a lot of other people, too. So the state has a lot to offer, and my family's here as well.
We'd all second that one. Michigan Radio's Mark Brush, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, let's bring in Susan Ager to continue the conversation. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Cindy. How are you doing?
I'm great. You wrote for the Detroit Free Press for 25 years as a reporter. You were a columnist, and you've spent a lot of that time thinking about these issues, about what it means to be from Michigan, to live in Michigan, and to stay in Michigan. And I'm wondering, how surprised are you by the poll results that we first talked about with Mark, that only 28% of us say Michigan is the best or one of the best possible states to live in?
Well, I am convinced that poll must have been taken in the depths of winter. Because I believe that if people had been asked in the spring, summer, or fall, far more of them would have ranked us at the top. The winters here are tough. We don't get sun like our neighbor Minnesota does. Their winters are harsher than ours in temperature, but they get sun. So that's a challenge. That's, you know, winter's a challenge. But I think it makes us tougher and better and more open to others and more friendly. More willing to, you know, bring a dish to a potluck. I think we're a great state of community and friendliness, openness. We're not closed in on ourselves. We want to be open, partly, I think, because of those tough winters.
And indeed, we did have that huge outpouring from people in the Why I Stay project. I guess that kind of supports what you're saying.
Yes. Well, you know, I think our deep ethnic roots, we have many, many big populations of people who've come from afar, either in the late 1800s or the early 1900s or more recently. And I think that creates a strong sense of roots here. People have family, people have friends. You don't uproot yourself that easily. And, you know, Mark was talking about the beauty. Who else can tattoo the shape of their state on their arm and have it mean anything? You know, Ohio is just not much of a tattoo.
Very good point. Very good point. I wondered if in this outpouring of response to Why I Stay, do you think it's a sense of pride of state, or is it more a sense that we feel like we're kind of the butt of the jokes right now, the real underdog, and we want to make up for that?
Well, I think that may be part of it, but and I think Detroiters definitely feel that way. You know, I was born in Detroit and worked in Detroit for many years, and when you're the underdog, you've got to fight back. You know, you've got to talk back. You've got to be sassy, and you've got to stand up for yourself. And you know, all these media who fly in and spend a day in Detroit and fly out and write about how terrible it is, we all know that's crapola, you know. Detroit's a fabulous geography of history and diversity and fighting back response, and good things are happening in Detroit, and people should spend more than a day there when they report. So there's part of that, but I think more of it is that we just realize how unique and unusual we are. I mean, look at Detroit and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. You know, Copper Harbor at the very tip of the Keweenaw, we're all in the same state. Isn't that astonishing?
You think about that. Yeah. There are countries that don't have that kind of...
have this diversity.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is a 10-hour drive from Detroit up to Copper Harbor. But, you know, people do it. People think of this river of people we have on I-75 every weekend heading up north. Up north, what a treasure it is. What a treasure. People can, there's a diversity of cities for people to choose from, a diversity of urban experiences, Detroit versus Grand Rapids versus Ann Arbor versus Traverse City. You know, these are all thriving cities. Well, Detroit's on the way to thriving, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great diversity of both urban, rural, and small town choices people can make here.
We offer you the sunrise side or the sunset side.
Yes, we do. We do. Yes, north, south, east, west, it's all great. And I travel, I don't know whether you recall, but for a few years I did a series called Tell Susan Ager Where to Go.
Yes.
And I sought ideas from readers on where I should visit and what I should write about. And I got thousands of suggestions of people's favorite places, people's favorite people. There is a deep love here for this state. And I would never leave. I lived in San Francisco for 7 years, and I came back, partly for love and partly because I missed my state.
What did you miss? Why have you stayed here? Why are your roots here so deep?
Oh, well, you know, again, I'm of Polish heritage. People in San Francisco didn't know how to pronounce punchki, you know. They didn't know what kielbasa was. It was, you know, I missed the food of the state. I missed the coney dogs and the cherry pies and the food identity is so strong here. And I missed everybody says this, you know, I miss the seasons, even winter. I love winter when it's, you know, as long as it's supposed to be and not any longer. And San Francisco was, you know, a lot of people. I don't think I met anybody in San Francisco who was born there.
Interesting.
You know, people were in and out. We're not an in and out state. You know, you come here and you're born here and you tend to stay here. It's what's not to like, I think.
Susan Ager, writer for the Detroit Free Press for decades, storyteller and Michigan lover. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Susan.
Thanks, Cindy.
The Why I Stay Project will run through tomorrow, so there's definitely time for you to head to michiganradio.org and search for the Why I Stay link to get all the details, and be sure to post your photos. Get your telescopes and binoculars ready. There's a once-in-a-lifetime meteor shower that's headed our way Friday night into Saturday morning. William Cook is the head of the Meteorite Environment Office at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. And Bill, you are the expert, so you get to say this meteor shower's tongue-twisting name for us.
Oh, but I'm from the South. I can't pronounce anything. Camelopardalids.
Camelopardalids. Now, I kind of think back to my Latin class, and doesn't that have some Latin root, like talking about a giraffe?
That's correct. When the Romans first encountered giraffes, they called them camelopards, hence camelopardalids. So it's the old Roman name for a giraffe.
And why are we calling this meteor shower the old Roman name for a giraffe?
Well, meteor showers take their name from the constellation that the meteors appear to come from. For example, Leonids come from Leo, Geminids come from the constellation of Gemini, and the camelopardalids will come from this constellation of the giraffe called Camelopardalis up near the North Star.
Now, we have seen lots of headlines saying that this really is a first-of-its-kind meteor shower. Why is that?
Well, meteor showers are caused when the Earth encounters debris left behind by comet or asteroid. And usually these are annual events, like the Perseids are caused by comet Swift-Tuttle, and the Earth encounters that debris in mid-August of every year. So for most meteor showers, they occur every year, and the debris pretty much intersects Earth's orbit at the same place. But with this one, these particles come from a comet called 209P Linear, which has an orbit that stretches out to Jupiter's. And Jupiter's gravity alters the debris left behind by the comet so that it's not in the same place year after year. And this year, on May 24th of 2014, Jupiter's gravity will tug that debris into Earth's path. And when we run into that debris, that will produce this new meteor shower.
And NASA's very confident that this is happening. You give us the date. We know it's coming Friday night into Saturday morning. Do we have any idea what we're going to see?
Well, we're confident of the time. I know that the peak will occur between, you know, 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Saturday morning. However, I don't know what sort of rates to expect, because it's all tied to how much dust comet 209P Linear produced in the 1700s and 1800s, and the comet wasn't discovered until 2004. So if 209P Linear produced a lot of debris a couple of centuries ago, then we could have a spectacular meteor shower with rates as high as 200 per hour. But if it produced very little debris a couple centuries ago, then we may see practically nothing. It's kind of like being able to tell you that it's going to rain in a week right at 11:30 a.m., but unable to tell you whether you're going to get a drizzle or a thunderstorm.
So it's the Camelopardalid meteor shower coming between, well, 2 to 4 a.m. this coming Saturday. So set your alarm or just stay up late.
That will be the peak time.
William Cook, head of the Meteoroid Environment Office at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for the meteor shower advice.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And now another product with Michigan roots. Kitty litter.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Did you know that product that cat owners could not live without was born out of a Cass County man trying to help his neighbor? That man was Edward Lowe. I'm joined now by Heidi Connor of the Edward Lowe Foundation, which is based in Cassopolis. Hello, Heidi.
Hello, and good morning.
Edward Lowe became one of Michigan's biggest entrepreneurial success stories, and it was strictly by accident, right? He came home after serving in the Navy in World War II and came home to Cass County and joined his father's company. And what was he doing?
His father sold aggregates, sand, sawdust, coal, and sawdust was replaced at that time by clay because of its absorbent nature, and it was not as much of a fire hazard. So they had these clay reserves lying around, and Kay Draper was friends with Ed, who was buying sand for her cat box, and he offered her the clay. And the reason why the clay worked was because clay will absorb its volume, and the sand will not.
Okay.
And so it lowered the exposure, and so it didn't smell.
So it was a total fluke. She just said, hey, you have anything that would work in my cat box? And he said, hey, try this.
Well, she had been coming to him for the sand, but the sand was frozen. It was outside. And inside his garage, he had a load of clay. So Ed offered it to her, and she told her girlfriends, and they all kept coming back for more. And Ed realized the potential, so he started marketing it. And he persevered until he got to a national distributorship.
And thanks to Kay Draper asking him for something for the kitty litter box, I got the sense that it really meant a change in the way that cat owners could interact with their cats.
Exactly. It was no longer an outdoor animal. Actually, cat box filler, you know, today it's a billion-dollar industry. It created a whole new product line, all the pet toys and all the pet products for cats. They didn't exist because cats lived outside.
And from his very successful career as an entrepreneur, he kept his Michigan roots intact, didn't he?
Yes, for him, he always used the phrase, all roads lead to Cassopolis.
Well, quite an interesting man, and all started in Cassopolis. Thank you so much, Heidi Connor of the Edward Lowe Foundation. It was good to talk with you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Still to come, the state's expanded Medicaid system, Healthy Michigan, is up and running, but the state still has work to do.
Across the board, enrollment has been a success, with the one exception being the Hispanic community. We've underperformed nationally and state-wise in reaching out to the Hispanic community. I think we need to do a little bit better job of that.
Coming up next, we find out what's stopping those who are newly eligible from signing up. Then we talk with a fish biologist and discover the upside to the new technology helping researchers track the unwanted Asian carp. That story's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Federal Health Care Exchange for Private Insurance under the Affordable Care Act closed on March 31st until the fall. The very next day, the attention then turned to Healthy Michigan, the state's expanded Medicaid system for some 477,000 low-income Michiganders. Don Hazard is director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare, which helps people sign up for this coverage. Don, 6 weeks in from the initial sign-up opening, how are numbers looking?
Well, I think everyone's pretty ecstatic about the numbers. We've exceeded even the more optimistic expectations. So just 6 weeks into the program, we've already enrolled 260,000 people approximately into the Healthy Michigan Plan. To put that into perspective, that's approaching 60% of the entire eligible population in Michigan. So the numbers are quite amazing. And that comes on the heels of a really successful enrollment in the private insurance market, where we enrolled over 272,000 individuals into subsidized health care through healthcare.gov.
Now, are there any problems people who want to sign up for Healthy Michigan are facing, you know, echoing problems last fall with the Affordable Care Act sign up?
No, and that's really part of what is so exciting here. This state, especially the Department of Community Health, did a fabulous job as far as the technology side. We're not experiencing any of the technical issues that we experienced on the private insurance side. So people are really experiencing no difficulty getting themselves enrolled. If someone is interested in attempting to enroll themselves, they can just go to healthymichiganplan.org. Or if they would like one-on-one assistance, my organization would be happy to help them. They can just visit enrollmichigan.com.
I'm wondering, why do you think, as you look at all of this, that there are still people that haven't signed up? What's stopping those who are eligible from jumping on board?
Well, I want to emphasize, we're only about 6 weeks into the program, and we've already enrolled close to 60% of the eligible population. So those are tremendous numbers. What is preventing the other 40%? Likely lack of information. We just haven't reached that population. We need a little more time to do so. There could be a number of issues involved. There could be language barriers. There could be health literacy issues. So it's going to take a little bit of time to get closer to that 100% mark. But the reality is we have done a very good job collectively, all of us involved in this process, getting a significant number of the eligible population enrolled to date.
I wonder if you've got any thoughts, Don, as far as whether some of this 40% who have not signed up, could that any of that have to do with perceptions of Obamacare, whether the website problems or perhaps they had friends who were kicked off their insurance or just swayed by political ads? Could that play a role in this?
Oh, I have no doubt it plays a role in it. And one of the leading studies done so far shows that the primary reason people don't attempt to get themselves enrolled is they think there is not going to be an affordable plan available to them. Now, that's not the case. For example, I was speaking to a woman just recently. Her monthly premium for her private insurance plan was 22 cents a month. 22 pennies a month is what she pays for her monthly premium for a private insurance plan. And that's not entirely a unique story. Of course, it fluctuates depending on your income. But the bottom line is people need to be aware that the plans are tremendously affordable thanks to subsidies. And with the Healthy Michigan plan, anyone below 138% of the federal poverty limit is automatically eligible for the Healthy Michigan plan. So they should be taking a really good look at that and their potential eligibility.
Yeah, but it does seem that it may say something about Obamacare being very, very linked to Healthy Michigan in people's minds in this state.
I don't think so. Clearly, there's been some partisan efforts to make the term Obamacare negative in people's minds. Perhaps the fact that the Healthy Michigan plan has not been labeled with that slang may be part of the reason for the success of the program, that it hasn't been politicized quite to the extent that the private insurance part of it is. But we have to keep in mind that whether we're talking about Healthy Michigan or whether we're talking about the private insurance piece of it, it's all part of the bigger plan that's the Affordable Care Act. And collectively, the act is having a huge impact as far as taking a bite out of the uninsured population in Michigan. I think we need to acknowledge the success of the act in its totality.
We're speaking with Don Hazer. Don's director of the Michigan Consumers for Healthcare, and they are helping people sign up for coverage, healthcare coverage, under Healthy Michigan, the state's expanded Medicaid system. There has been discussion, Don, about whether Medicaid HMOs will have enough doctors to be ready and handle the increase in enrollees because of Healthy Michigan. We know that the state's already had a long-time shortage of primary care physicians. That goes back 10 years or so. And now we have many tens of thousands of new patients who will be entering the system. What do you hear from the HMOs?
Well, policymakers in the past had essentially institutionalized discrimination against people on Medicaid in that they reimbursed physicians a lower rate for taking a Medicaid patient versus taking a Medicare patient. Under the Affordable Care Act, primary care physicians get reimbursed the same amount, regardless of whether they're seeing a Medicare patient or a Medicaid patient. So that takes away that encouragement to discriminate against individuals on Medicaid. And all the HMOs have a responsibility to put together an adequate network, and it is the state's responsibility to enforce that and to ensure that all of these plans are putting in place an adequate network of physicians, and it is likewise the responsibility of the network, the insurance companies themselves, to make sure their enrollees receive lists of all available physicians that take their insurance.
Is there a concern that there will be enough primary care physicians for these for all of these patients?
Well, that's something we need to continue to monitor. The state has authorized these HMOs and is saying that these HMOs have adequate networks in place. That's something we have to continue to monitor in the future and make sure that's the case. But at this point, we're not receiving any negative feedback to the extent that consumers are not finding physicians. So I think time will tell on that, and we'll have to continue to monitor that situation. But as of right now, the state is saying that the insurance companies have adequate networks in place.
What's the next target you're looking for in the sign-up? What's the next benchmark?
Well, we don't set a specific number, but what we would like to do is put an added emphasis towards the Hispanic community. I think that across the board, enrollment has been a success, with the one exception being the Hispanic community. We've underperformed nationally and state-wise in reaching out to the Hispanic community. I think we need to do a little bit better job of that.
Why do you think that is, the reticence in the Hispanic community?
Well, clearly a language barrier is in place there. And I think we have to acknowledge that both at the federal level and here at the state level, we have to do a better job overcoming that language barrier and also recognizing cultural differences within the Hispanic community versus other communities, and partner with organizations that already have those relationships within that community.
You can get online information at healthymichiganplan.org. And as Don said, you can get one-on-one help in signing up for Healthy Michigan by going to enrollmichigan.com. Don Hazard, Michigan Consumers for Healthcare. Thank you so much for talking with us. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
When you hear the words Asian carp, chances are not much that is good will come to mind. We know they're big, they're ugly, they're lightning fast, they're voracious eaters, and highly invasive. And there are great fears as to what could happen if they decide to really settle in and make the Great Lakes home. But my next guest is among the scientists who say, well, there has been an upside to all the study they've been doing since the Asian carp came onto our radar screens. Dwayne Chapman is a research fish biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. He leads their Asian carp research. We've been hearing this steady drumbeat of alarm about what these fish could do to the Great Lakes. But has studying the Asian carp advanced our understanding of fish and of water ecology?
Oh, absolutely. And developed new techniques. I mean, it's like a... if you decide to go to the moon, you're going to have to develop some new things along the way that turn out to be useful for other things. And that's certainly happening with Asian carp.
And give us an idea of some of these new technologies that have come into being now as you try to track these fish.
There's a lot of different acoustic tools that are being used now to count fish and look at their behavior. Some of these things are like an acoustic camera. Now, the technology wasn't developed for fish, but we have to develop methods that make it useful for fish. And so for hundreds of years, bird scientists have been able to go to the field and look at the birds and write down what they're doing. And,
right.
You know, and so with fish, that's really an unusual thing, because usually our fish, you know, we can't see them. They live in this muddy water, especially for these turbid rivers. And we now have acoustic video that has been developed for a lot of purposes, but we're now moving that into the biological realm and being able to employ some of the same types of biological research methods that, say, a bird person could, even in really muddy water. It's a little bit blurry of a picture, that's for sure, but nevertheless, it's very, very exciting because we can learn things about fish that we could never hope to do before.
You've also got a better understanding of how fish secrete their DNA, don't you?
That's right. A tremendous amount of work going on right now with a thing called environmental DNA, where we take samples from the rivers or lakes, and we can tell what kinds of things are in the water because of this environmental DNA. We're using this to track where Asian carps are, but it's still a really new technology. It's a little bit hard to interpret what it really means when you do get a positive hit, but it's actually, this technology, it works even better for endangered and really rare organisms than it does for tracking the expansion of an existing really big population, because with this giant population of Asian carp, there's ways for some of that DNA to get into these new places, and you kind of wonder how it got there. But when you have an endangered species, now that we have this technology, we can go in and say, okay, well, maybe these fish are here and we don't know because we can't find them because they're so rare.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have this giant pool of DNA that's not too far away that things are likely to be transferred from. So it works really – it's really a wonderful technique for looking at extremely rare species. And, you know, we can learn more about the habitats used by where existing populations of endangered organisms are.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Duane Chapman. He is a research fish biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey, and he leads their Asian carp research. And as a fish scientist, Duane, what impresses you about the Asian carp?
They're some of the best filter-feeding fishes in fresh water. They can do things like they're hearing specialists. They can hear things that most other fish can't hear. And each of the four species that we call Asian carp, the bighead, silver, black, and grass carp, kind of have a unique capability for their particular feeding type that is different from nearly every fish in the world, at least or advanced to a stage that's better than nearly every other freshwater fish. So they're really super highly adapted fishes, but somehow they remain very flexible in their behavior, which is unusual. They're extremely interesting fish to work with. I just wish they weren't here in the U.S. because in terms of any upside that we might find due to the expansion of these fish, if they were to get into yet another place, would be probably outweighed by the negatives.
Mm. But it is amazing when you think about being so adaptable that they can survive from the southern United States to just up by the Arctic Circle in both fresh and salt water.
Right. Yeah, they're moving into a fish was caught in the Gulf of Mexico in Alabama recently. Or no, that was Mississippi. Sorry, but clear out into what is, you know, reasonably high salt water. I mean, they've got the Mississippi River coming in there.
Mm-hmm.
Fishes in the minnow family are typically confined to pretty much fresh water, but the Asian carps, in so many ways, are the exception once again, and that they are able to move into high salinity water. And that's a problem because as they move into these high salinity waters and move along the coast, they can move up another river and colonize another system without actually anybody moving them. So that's a problem. They are native all the way from the southern part of China and all the way up into Kamchatka in Russia, and they've been transplanted and doing fine in tropical zones. So, that's a pretty wide range.
Yeah.
Again, they're incredibly flexible in the kind of habitats that they are able to invade. They do have some Achilles heels in that regard. One of the things that's really important is that they, for Asian carps, is they need to have a river of a certain length in order to be able to breed. They can't live in a pond and reproduce. Their eggs would sink to the bottom and the eggs would die. So one of the things that we're trying to use against these fish is we can go to these different rivers and measure things about the rivers. And now we can model these rivers to tell us which rivers are potentially Asian carp spawning habitats. And then we have a chance, once we've done that, to go in and either modify the rivers, put in low-head dams, put in barriers.
And then, you know, knowing that there you are really front lines of trying to develop the science and the technology to keep these out of the Great Lakes, and you say they're coming down the pipeline, and everyone who is concerned about keeping the Great Lakes what they are probably has to ask the question, will it come in time? Will you be able to develop control methods that are effective before they infest the Great Lakes?
Right, and it is a race against time. When the sea lamprey invaded the Great Lakes, it was a disaster. The large fishes were already pretty overfished, but the sea lampreys really did them in, and they destroyed many, many large fish. And so there really wasn't much of a fishery left in the Great Lakes for a while after the sea lamprey invaded. But we did catch up to them, and we developed a specific toxicant, which is directed at the lamprey, and it works. It costs a lot of money. There's millions of dollars spent every year to control sea lampreys, but it is successful, and the controlling of the sea lamprey has brought that fishery back, and the fishery is worth billions. So, and in that case, it's a cost-effective thing that has been done. It took more than a decade to develop and deploy the sea lamprey directed toxicants. And Asian carps aren't magic fish either. They are manageable if we have the will to do so. It's just a matter of finding out the right techniques, using the appropriate technology, and trying to do things in the most cost-effective way without damaging native fishes or people's livelihoods. It's all going to be a tricky thing, and things get more complex every year in terms of all the different players. It's a big task that's set upon us, but I do think that we will be able to manage Asian carps, and I'm optimistic that even if at some point we do get big head and silver carp and grass carp all reproducing at potentially problematic levels in the Great Lakes, that we will be able to develop controls for them.
The view from the front line and the fight to keep Asian carp from infesting the Great Lakes. We've been talking with Dwayne Chapman. He's a research fish biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. Always good to talk with you, Dwayne. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're wondering what's on your mind. What stories would you like us to focus on or people we should talk about? It's easy to share with us. Just go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Candy. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, you can go to michiganradio.org, click on the link that says Stateside. You can leave us comments and also check out stories that you may have missed. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Omar Sude, Katie Suha, Jeff Warniak, and Chrissy Zamurin. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.